for Mark to interview.
Why did they give us a new number? No, yeah, I got that email.
You got that, okay.
I don't know what the number is offhand, but I'll find it because I have it.
Well, let's get the show on the road.
And I had so much stuff to talk about tonight now, too.
We still can.
Many, 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 many amounts of time.
Patton is optimism.
Dan needs to be bitch slapped back into reality. Get a grip, Dan.
I don't know what's going on. Where am I?
It looks like you got the stream going. You need to record and start the show.
Yeah.
Focus, Dan. Focus. The eye on the prize.
The eye on the... All right, you guys ready? That's it, I swear. Fucking Apple.
Let's go off, man.
All right, are you ready, Alan?
Sure, why not?
Let's see what happens. I got it. You know what? I cleaned up the office a bit this week, and I should have cleaned... I knew I should have cleaned that area up. All right, here we go. We're going to do the countdown.
Stop you crying.
No special hog stuff. Screwed it up. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Technology, an hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up. Link it up and take it away.
Take it away.
Come on, Dan. Get with the program. Focus. Ding, an Apple products. Piece of...
I tried cleaning that contact on there earlier today, and it was working fine. And I guess I just got to break out the file and scrape it down.
So we had a little bit of problems here. What
I had a lot of problems.
Let's go with what happened here.
Yeah. Well, it looks like... Littlefinger's probably got to playing with some of the knobs on there.
Well, we
more than that, the audio, this external sound card might be going into the dumper.
How much did you pay for that?
$50.
Yeah. How long have you had it?
A little over a year.
Yeah, that's about right.
And that just nothing.
I'm sorry, I'm 20 seconds behind you guys.
That's okay.
Pissing me off. Let's see if anybody's in here.
Lincoln?
I can't even dial the number right.
You are currently the only person in this conference.
Sorry.
At least Asterisk is working.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Asterisk keeps on churning, man.
Yeah, it just keeps on going.
So we got a lot of things to talk about this week. Are you still running KDE, Dan, or no?
Yeah, I'm still running KDE.
Now, I listened to last week's episode because I was on for only a little bit because my son was sick. And... Link had a question whether or not KDE auto mounts like thumb drives and stuff. On my system, it does.
It's dependent on how this, the
how it's configured and
yeah,
set
how
up.
It's configured.
By
default, it doesn't.
Yeah, mine was working, no problem. Anytime I mount an external drive or anything, it pops in.
Yeah, well, that's your Kinotics.
Yes.
You are currently the only person in this conference.
I know Slack doesn't do that by default.
Now you're running KDE, Dan, but it doesn't look like KDE.
No, it looks like all my other. It's because I have the. And because I'm.
You got all those little applets, those Fluxbox-like applets running.
No.
Separately.
I don't have any applets running.
So what is that on the end? Then there's those gauges.
Oh, that's GK Relum.
Oh, okay.
Because I like GK Relum better. I tried some of the Flux. I tried Super Karamba.
Yeah, I've tried
and
that.
And I ran that for about a half an hour.
Yeah,
and
it's a toy.
Shut the damn
it's
thing
a toy.
Off. I tried to get the XMMS thing running. It just wasn't happening.
Let me ask you, like, it looks like you made the toolbar small and transparent.
Yeah, I tweaked it out a bit. Gave it my own personality.
So how do you like it so far?
I like it. What's bothering me for some reason is I turned off my monitor. I turned off the power management features for the monitor, but the monitor keeps going blank. And I don't know why. I don't know what I did in the past couple of days, but it wasn't doing that for the longest time. And now all of a sudden, it just started doing it again. I upped. The only thing I did is I went under my screensaver settings.
Huh? You're overdriving your monitor.
Yeah, I went in my screensaver settings, and I turned it to lock it after 10 minutes, I think it was, or turn on the screensaver after 10 minutes and instead of 5. And ever since I did that, and I tried unchecking power management, but then I checked it again and I said, look, let's look at it actually what it is. It's me sitting here trying to talk about it. I'm trying to remember. It's not working. Under appearances, where is the screensaver? Under the advanced tab, I make aware of power management. If you click that and you do advanced, what is it? Advanced? No. Under setup, what is it? No. Where is that? Ah! Oh. It's not there. Where is that setting?
What do you got on there, Ubuntu?
Yeah, Ubuntu. Let me pull up the control center. It's always... Oh, it makes me want to cry, Alan. Oh, yeah, it's under appearance and themes. Isn't it...
screensaver, no?
No, desktop, monitor. No, peripherals, display, that's it. Power control. Enable display power management. Standby after disable. Power off after disable. I disabled all of it. It shouldn't be turning itself off.
So what was the main reason why you went to KDE? Anything particular? Any application?
I've just been hearing so many people saying how great it is.
Well, Conker is nice, man.
It is. I switched to it because I want to find out exactly what applications are on this machine.
Okay.
Because if I use Fluxbox or something, because I don't.
You
got to
go searching for
it. You got to put it in by hand.
They're not
pain in the ass,
there,
man.
Yeah. And I end up only using the same 5 or 6 applications all the time. So I figured, well, let's just run KDE for a little bit, so I, you know, start playing around with things some more. And you know, it's running fine. I have the only problems I've noticed with it are certain applications. Like last week, it was Skype, and now this week. It just seems certain applications take a little longer to start up. But other than
maybe that's an Ubuntu thing.
I don't know. I tried out Amarok, and I liked Amarok until I used it for more than 3 minutes.
I tried it too, and I wasn't really that much into it.
I was really getting into it, and I was like, this is cool. And I played a podcast, one of the tech podcasts. I forget what it is. And after about 3 minutes into it, the damn thing locked up. It kept playing, but I couldn't control it. The only way I could stop it was to kill the process. It just locked up. It does that thing where the display just freezes.
Have you tried Caffeine?
No.
Caffeine is like a front-end design, but you can also play your audio files. And I've been playing with that recently. That's pretty nice. I like that.
Just good old XMMS.
Yeah.
XMMS is fine.
What I liked about Amarok is like it built all that playlist stuff for you.
It builds like a meta database and
yeah, and I could just go in there and click on something to play. And I thought it was really cool, but it wasn't wasn't liking it.
That was now, really cool, but
I like XMMS too, but look at this. Watch the XMMS screen. Let's double the size of it.
Hey, that's a neat.
That's Ubuntu, man. That's nothing to do with KDE.
Why is that broken?
Works for me.
And like I can't
does it do that on normal screen as well?
Huh?
Excuse me, does it do that on normal screen as well, not double sized?
No, here it is normal, see? I have no problems. The moment I try and double size it,
it's Ubuntu, man.
It's gotta be something with that.
Just find another skin for it that's a little bit larger. No.
It's when I have to look at it from here over to there that
that's
the problem.
That's what
yeah.
So what else is going on?
Kudos. Did I just blow you away? I can't hear anything in this ear. It is still a little faint in this ear.
Do you want the other head? Do you want your other set of
you know what,
250 headphones?
I got to clean the contacts. When I scraped them down when I had it in here, it was working fine. And then we changed everything. It's just the contact. Because I had the same problem with my other headphones. For some reason, my headphones just don't like me. kudos to Adrian Bacon.
Because they know what you did to the last pair.
Adrian Bacon?
Adrian Bacon of the Linux Log. I don't know if you guys still listen. I listen all the time. But finally, even though he still has an ad on there for gotomeeting.com, he acknowledged the fact that it's a Windows Internet Explorer application only. It doesn't run in Windows, Mac. It doesn't run in Linux. So, like I complained about that last week, the one that was released this week, he acknowledged the fact that it doesn't run on Linux. That's great. Good job. Whatever happened to the what was it? The Tech Geek Show? Marshall?
Never listened to that one.
Because I haven't seen a new one released in a while.
Well, I saw on the Twop podcast, Droops, he's basically suspended all activity for a month.
Yeah, to reorganize.
Regroup.
And get some backup and get some more people. But, you know, hey, fine.
It works for me.
But, yeah, I was thinking there for a second. You were talking about Twit, because I listened to Twit this week. And,
I don't know what it is about Droops. He has this thing about Kevin Rose. I don't know.
Yeah.
I couldn't care less about Kevin Rose.
So, Amarok didn't do me good. Now, I do want to... where's Link? Where is Link?
Is he in the conference room?
I don't know if he's in the conference. I don't know where he is. Yeah. I don't know what he's trying to do.
For those who haven't figured it out yet, Link's not here tonight.
Yeah. Wait, did I close down my phone?
Did you?
I think
he did.
He could be online there and... I don't know whether I want to use K-Phone or whether I want to use...
How is K-Phone?
Well, we'll try it in just a minute. It works fine, as far as I know.
How's the sound quality? Is it SIP or is it AIX?
SIP.
Now, there's also that other one. What is it, GoIAX?
Yeah, no, that's IAXCOM.
How do you like that?
I like that one a lot.
Supposedly, that uses the AIX codec, which is supposedly a little better quality than SIP. Have you ever used that on Alan?
I'll start over again because I was 20 seconds behind. I keep trying to make sure that the audio
com.
Is going all right. What is it?
AIXCOM. It's a different client to use with the ASRIC server.
Obviously not, no.
Yeah. It uses the AIX codec, which is what the ASRIC natively supports.
Eventually, I'm going to set up my own ASRIC, but I haven't gotten to it yet. Mainly, I need a machine to do it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's kind of ugly looking.
It's straightforward.
Yeah, but if it works, you know.
Although.
Yeah.
Although maybe not tonight.
Dan doesn't have it configured.
Oh!
He's got it set up for that ASRIC server you were hitting.
Yes. I had it set up for.
Go AX.
So Dan's going to reconfigure everything on the fly right now.
Yes, I am.
You got to love Dan.
Yeah.
Have you guys listened? You guys ever heard of the King Commando show? It's one of these syndicated technology shows that are on a whole bunch of different stations around the country. The local AM talk radio station over here in the Lehigh Valley area, they play her on Sundays from like 7 in the morning to like I think 10 or 11, and basically, it's people calling in, you know, complaining about Windows, it sucks, viruses, blah, blah, blah. And she generally, you know, tells them, yeah, this is your problem. You know, she walks them through. Not very different from any other technology radio show that you hear these days. The thing I didn't like about it was that it seemed like all the solutions that she provided, she was pushing people towards products that were sold by her sponsors. And that kind of perturbs me.
Isn't that why you have a sponsor?
That's how you keep sponsors.
Yeah, but, you know, you want to be honest to people, though, you know? It's like, oh, you want to migrate your machine to a new machine? Here, use this product. This thing will migrate all your important, you know, files off your Windows box. $40, you know? You know, she doesn't say, you know, you can go out and buy, you know, a $6 Ethernet cable and do the same thing.
Yeah, but the people who call into talk shows asking for advice like that usually aren't the people who are going to figure it out that you could do that with a $6 cable.
Yeah, you know, but listen, I understand it's a business and she's got advertising to sell and all that other nonsense, but you gotta give people more choices and more options and try to be a little more honest and genuine about it, you know?
Well, again, you know.
Have you ever listened to her show?
No, I've never listened to her show, but again, you know. You push your sponsors because you gotta pay for airtime.
Listen, I understand that. It's not very much different from what Leo Laporte does on KFI, that LA station. I mean, you can download his shows, you know, and you can listen to, you know, the format and who he talks to, and it's pretty much the same thing, you know. It's you know, Windows noobs, you know, people who are pretty clueless for the most part, you know. But at least, you know, Leo at least, you know, tries to give them all the options.
Well, it could be that she's just, you know, reading what a tech is saying to her too.
Well, she says she, you know, she's the digital goddess and she
she's
an IT professional. I looked on her bio and she, you know, it's all I got out of her bio was that her mother worked on the Unix way back in the day, and as a kid growing up she was surrounded by Unix, blah blah blah.
So she's basically an MSE.
And then she worked as in sales for a bunch of years. And somehow she started writing for websites and doing radio.
But, okay, so chances are for most of her answers, she's reading off of a crew.
Probably. She probably has, you like, know, two, so three guys sitting in a room.
Yeah,
you know?
who pre-screen and come up with the answers. And she's just reading them off of a prompt.
Probably.
So, you know, of course, she's just going to go, well, then this is my sponsor here, so, okay, I'm going to feed that into it, you know. And
I don't know.
People, I guess, are more obvious feeding in their sponsors.
I couldn't take too much of it. After a while, I was like, enough of this crap, and I shut it off.
Well, and that's, you know, because you're also probably far more advanced than the newbies calling in, too. I'm hoping.
I hope.
So, you know.
I got a Windows computer for Christmas.
Alan.
See that? I didn't catch any of that.
As soon as I tell you, press the enter key on my keyboard.
What's the matter, VNC session out?
Go ahead. Yes.
The enter has been pushed.
Alan's made himself useful for the night.
Yep, I can go home now. Thank you very much.
Why don't you want to use the X10 client?
Turn off your caps.
Now I'm stuck in like cap locks mode with this.
That's VNC, no?
Yes. I don't know why it does this. I don't know how that happens.
Hey.
So should we tell everybody to go and click on the map to tell us where
yes,
they are?
Yes, we have a Frapper website. Alan, if you want to post it on the chat.
Yeah.
You know, people can
Alan,
go.
Alan, if you want to find it first.
It's the Linux Link Tech Show.
Yeah, no, I've got to get
that. And all it is this website where you can go in and add yourself and it'll have like a little map and where everybody's located. I think so far we got like about 20 people. So, you know, if anybody wants to go on and add themselves, that would be cool. You know, just to see it. All the pretty little pictures on the map.
Alan, hit enter.
The other announcement that we have is that the DVD is officially ready for shipping. A couple of people emailed me. They're interested in getting it. So I will send those out as soon as possible. And if anybody else is interested, the DVD is ready to go. Contact us and we'll send you a DVD. It's got everything, basically. Everything, including the kitchen sink, basically. It's got OGG. It's got the MP3s. It's got the videos. It's got some video footage that's not on the website. It's got all the bits. It's got everything. $10, you can't beat it.
$10 Then buy.
And the whole disc is pretty much full.
Buy the DVD. See, now we're advertising our DVD now.
Hey, whatever, man.
I don't understand why all of a sudden it just decides to go into...
Why it decides to
You
dial.
Are currently the only person in this conference.
Why it just all of a sudden decides to just go capitalize, and I can't stop it.
Maybe that's an Apple issue.
Hey, what's the address for the map again?
It's the same thing except the Linux link text share.
Yeah, but I can't FR. I don't know. The bulletin board has it.
So
yeah, we're all well prepared this evening.
Yeah, we're like running here like chickens with no heads.
Yeah.
So Dan, have you had more issues with your Apple Wireless card at work? Fighting with the Apple representative, trying to convince him that the wireless card's a piece of crap.
We had the Apple representatives in on Monday. Let's read an Apple email.
It helps if I spell things correctly.
Let's call. What time do we have to call? What time are we calling? Was it Mark?
Yes, Mark.
What time are we calling?
I told him 9-ish.
9-ish. Okay. Let's read an email. Oh, where's that email from that guy? I gotta check that out. I'll do that one.
What are you talking about?
All right. This is a great email. Listening
this is a good
email. To episode 107. And I hope this helps defray the hate mail for your realistic comments of OS X 10. I'm tired of all the Apple hype and the OS X hoopla, and hope to hear more accurate comparison on future shows. He mails the show support. If I may vent, but in all my years, I've never seen a serious operating system that worked like something from Fisher Price. My recent experience with Apple and OS X on a new X serve at work has me hating Apple more than Windows. Command line tools that are known not to work since version 10.1, yet are printed in the 10.3 command line reference, diluted Samba and open LDAP features. We changed 1,600 passwords in 10 minutes on our 2003 Active Directory server. Took days hand typing on OS X because the LDAP tools don't work. Once again, documented in the manuals. My favorite, after reloading our test server 3 times because its permissions keep freaking out, only to find later from Apple, oops, the Finder doesn't show permissions correctly in 10.4.2. No wonder 10.4.3 is supposed to fix 500 bugs or so. I believe it. After our system stopped creating mount paths correctly for 2 out of every 10 users created, Apple gave us a fix, which involved breaking our mount point and reapplying it. Thank goodness we did it on a test image, for while it worked, though Work Root Manager still showed erroneous paths, it set our root password to the dir admin password and locked us out of Work Root Manager on the server. I'm sick and tired of Apple field technicians blaming its customers for using non-standard and unsupported methods, yet when something doesn't work or is denied by omission on the Apple website, they refer us to Apple user sites, and that's user in quotes. The boss is a Mac head, but I smile every time his OS X web server goes deaf and I have to reboot it for him. I always point out that the other web servers, Fedora 1 and SUSE Enterprise Linux 9, keep ticking. Love the show. Keep it up. So that's a unhappy Mac user.
Hear, hear.
Now, I you know what? I don't have as many problems as he has, because we haven't gotten to that point of taking our OS X servers to the next level, because we've run into too many roadblocks with integrating into LDAP and everything like that. It doesn't work properly. Documentation isn't complete. But, you know, you talk to the Apple techs and they're like, it's so easy to do. It's all documented
on the
Apple website. But it doesn't work.
It's the Apple way.
Then you must have a problem on your end. You know, the whole thing with the wireless. You know, why is the PowerBook getting 30 feet and everybody else is getting on a Windows PC getting
because
like
Windows
75
PCs
feet.
Are plastic.
That's not
and,
right.
And
right.
PowerBooks are titanium.
It's unbelievable that you get more range out of the Windows PC than. So I brought the guys. I said, look, this is what was happening. Oh, you have ceramic tile in your hallways. It's blocking the signal.
It's always something you're doing.
Yeah. Why is the Windows PC? First was the tools I was using weren't accurately showing because
Apple, they're not Apple products.
Because they weren't Apple, but when I got the Apple products, they were showing me the exact same thing the other tools were showing me. Then the response was, well, you know what? He's probably getting a signal, but the quality of that signal is really low. Apple, if the quality gets to a certain point, just shuts the signal off. Doesn't even recognize it's there. So we know what's better for you. We know better than you do. The reason why he's probably getting a really – he's got a lot of noise, a really bad signal, and it's still saying it's connected, but it's really crappy connection, and we feel that Apple, because of quality assurance, decides that that connection is not going to be useful. Even though he's browsing the web, browsing the network,
doing whatever
he wants. And then this is great. They said to me, you can't trust the graphical utilities on Windows to show you an accurate representation of the signal strength. So right then and there, you know, they put you in a corner and say, well, you understand that what you're seeing is not correct.
I agree with you. You can't trust Windows.
Oh, no, I know you can't. I know you can't. And the fact that when we looked at his display of his network connection and signal strength, they were usually, you know, unless he got really far away, then you'd see it go down. They were up above 80% while I was down there below 30%. And Apple's response to that is you can't trust the Windows. You can't trust that.
The utility is lying to you.
That utility is lying to you. Actually, he's probably down about to where you are, but it's not showing it accurately. And when you get just a little bit further and there's too much noise and too much, the signal isn't that strong, we're just going to cut you off because we don't want you to. We feel that at that point the signal's not, we don't have enough confidence in that signal, so you shouldn't either. So we're going to cut it off for you. That was their response.
How generous of them.
Yes. How generous. Thank you. So I'm 10 feet away from the device, and my signal is under 70%. And they say to me, well, you got to be further away than that because the wavelength of the signal, you're too close, and the wavelength of the signal is not optimal. So even though I got to be further than 10 feet away, but no further than 40 feet away.
Sounds like horseshit to me, man.
So I got
to
be in that.
I'm calling bullshit.
Yeah, I got to be.
I'm jumping in. This is an intervention.
15, if I want to get the optimal signal, I got to be 15 to, I guess, 35 feet from the airport in the same room. Now, their response to us, the ideal way to do this for our entire building is an airport in every classroom. And then they said, well, you have overlap then? You know, he said, put an airport in every classroom. Turn the power down on that so that it only covers that classroom. Then you have no problem.
So as long as you buy more units from them, it'll work, of course.
Solve the problem by throwing money at it.
Of course.
Airport. So this is the song and dance I got from them. And they did admit that the PowerBook, because of design, isn't going to get the distance that an iBook is. Because of the design, probably design the case, but it should outperform a Windows PC.
Because Apple is superior product, right?
Right. Now the thing is, just pop in a live CD and use Wi-Fi radar to see. I have not gotten a live CD to. You know what? I can't use a live CD because this is a PPC. I can't use PPC.
Are there any PPC live distros?
There is. I haven't gotten it to work.
I think Gentoo had one, but it's very basic.
Ubuntu has one.
I'd say the Ubuntu one.
And I didn't get it to work. I tried it on two different machines, and I had problems. No, I got it to work a little bit on an iBook. It won't matter because
the card won't work.
Yeah,
anyways.
The Airport Extreme card does not work under Linux. So
because they don't release the driver APIs or anything.
Right. So you know what?
I understand all the stuff people are
saying to me about the wavelength and all that stuff. And that this is what I was told by Apple. You know what? How can you argue? What are you going to do? Sit there and say...
All I have to say is I won't be contributing to Uncle Steve's retirement fund anytime soon.
So...
Well, I like my mini, so...
Good for you.
Yeah, good. Pat yourself on the back.
Ready to speak to our guest here?
Yeah.
We're gonna talk.
I have so much more I was going to complain about.
Well, we can get back to that later. We can bring that up again.
Where's my phone? I forgot what I did with the phone.
There it is.
Oh. All right.
That's K-phone you're using? Or is that... That's...
Yeah. Should we try it?
Why not? Got the number?
Let's actually see if it's going to work. Maybe I should stick with... Let's just make sure it's going to actually...
I haven't played with K-phone. Well, the other clients, I should.
It's nice... Hi, how you doing?
Hi, who's this?
This is me.
You're the guinea pig.
What?
Can you hear us okay?
You're the guinea pig.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear us?
Nothing?
No, not a bit.
Nothing?
No, it's all weird and wavery.
How about now? A little better?
No, I can't. I can hear you, but it's just... Doesn't make it, I can't hear your words.
The quality sucks, is what you're saying.
All right, let me try. Okay, I'm gonna hang up. Well, I guess we won't be using K-phone.
I guess not. why don't we just go with the XM client? Dan's getting more and more frustrated.
I can't.
This could end up being the shortest show we've ever had because he's getting so frustrated.
He looks like the Hulk on the pictures behind him.
Hulk, no lie.
Hulk rage.
For all those people who sent in links to comic book podcasts, I thank you very much. I'm listening right now to Comicology and Comic Book Geek Speak. Good stuff.
Someday we're going to mute that.
Yeah, we got to mute that thing.
Hello?
Does that sound better now?
That's much better.
Ah, I see. Yeah. It's K-phone is the problem.
All right.
Thank you.
That's all we wanted.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
That's all right.
Bye. That was Aaron's contribution for the show.
For tonight. No Slurpees, huh?
That's a good, damn good point.
Got the number, handy dandy? Dan, we should get to our guests. So.
Yes, I'm going to get to our guests.
You're bad, bad.
Oh.
Yeah, I'd like to order a Slurpee.
Yeah, Slurpee lady's not working tonight.
Oh, you stink.
She's on strike.
You know what? You know what the problem is? Is that when it's... This is like a three-person call, isn't it?
Not really.
Hon?
Yeah, what? What?
Is there another person?
We're all here. We're talking.
Oh, because whenever that, whoever, that, okay, is that Patrick?
Yes.
Whenever Patrick tries to talk and you talk at the same time, they cancel each other out.
Yeah, well, we won't have
that. So then I can't hear anybody talk.
Okay, well, thank you.
So, okay. You're welcome.
I love you, bye.
No Slurpees. Love you, bye.
Damn it.
That's... She's fired.
Alan, you want to go out?
No.
All right.
Dang, you're driving us insane.
Yeah, no one's going to be able to pick that number out. All right. That looks right, right?
I don't know. I don't have the number in front of me.
No, it hits right down here. Ah, the joy of a live show.
Let's do it. Do it.
All circuits are busy now. Please try your call again later.
You don't need to dial a 9 for a line out?
Oh, come on.
Do it.
Hey, Jim, this is Mark's office.
Hi, Mark. It's Dan from the Linux Link Tech Show.
Hey, how's it going? This is Matt, actually. He just ran out for just a second, but he wanted to make sure I got the phone in case it rang while he ran out. But he should be back in like a minute or something. He's trying to bath. So
talk.
No problem.
He could just start talking when he comes back.
Yeah. Just so he knows that we are live right now. So he's aware of that when he comes back.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, no problem.
Cool, yeah.
Well, whenever he comes back, just, you know, put him on and we'll be good to go.
No problem.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Awesome.
Good to hear.
So now, are you, what do you do there at Digium?
I do software development and a little bit of hardware. I do software and hardware work, and I work on Asterisk. So, I guess I'm an Asterisk developer.
Do you run Asterisk at home, too?
I do, actually. Yep. Do you guys have much experience with Asterisk?
We're talking to you right now on one.
Okay, here he is. He just got back. Hello?
Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
How you doing today?
Pretty good.
This is Dan.
How about you?
Oh, pretty good. This is Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Alan and Pat are here.
Hello.
Okay.
And so you know we are live right now.
Cool. Cool.
So you can curse all you want, but...
We won't dump you.
You said we're not live or we are live?
No, we are live.
We are live, okay.
I just wanted you to be aware of that.
Okay.
All right.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're the founder of Digium. You're the guys who brought us this great product called Asterisk.
That's right.
Now, you started the company by yourself, or?
Well, it's kind of funny. The company started out as Linux Support Services back in 1999. And I started actually to provide general purpose Linux technical support. And I had, you know, just a few thousand dollars, like $4,000 between myself and my parents that we put in to help me start it. So, you know, I realized I kind of needed a phone system, and I wasn't about to go out and buy one, so I decided to write one. And that's kind of how Asterisk got started. And then, you know, I made it open source, but in 1999, it wasn't really very useful for most people. And then around 2001, we sort of realized, you know, this Asterisk thing might be the way to go rather than, you know, doing this Linux technical support, you know, which is a very hard business to be in. And so we refocused the company around Asterisk and started selling Asterisk-related hardware services and so on.
It seems that you guys mostly do hardware and support, right?
Right, mostly hardware and support. We do have a dual licensing component so that you can get Asterisk code, the same code, either under an open source license or under a more traditional proprietary license, if you know, that's what you need. We have a business edition of the software that's not feature differentiated, but it goes through much more formalized regression testing and is sort of like, I guess, like a Red Hat Enterprise version, and that's called business.
So it's more like an enterprise type product, you know, higher capacity or more stability.
I'm sorry.
It's more of an enterprise product.
Well, feature wise, it's the same. It's just that it's gone through more formalized testing. It comes with support and more traditional software warranties. So, you know, if those things are important to you, then you know the business edition is what you want to do. I mean, most people that are at their house, you know, don't need necessarily, you know, that extra level of testing. And certainly if you're out there, you know, wanting to actually work on the source code and work on the code base, you're going to want to stick with the open source TPL version. But for people, you know, that aren't really as concerned about having the latest feature set and they're happy with the feature set that's there, they just are really concerned about, you know, stability and reliability, and they want something that's not going to be moving, then for them, the business edition makes sense.
It seems Asterisk is really the buzzword application these days in Linux. Everybody seems to be talking about it lately.
Well, it's interesting to me that Asterisk is really much more popular in the VoIP world, it seems, than in the Linux world. I found that if you go talk to most anybody that's involved in the voice over IP industry, you know, it's much rarer to find someone that doesn't know what Asterisk is than it is to go ask, you know, a Linux user, you know, what do you know about Asterisk? And I think part of that is that the telecom industry has really been ripe for an open source solution for a long time, whereas if you look at Linux users, you know, it's kind of hard to get people excited about telephones generally, you know? I mean, most people just don't get that excited, although I will say that the people who do get excited about telephones get really excited about telephones.
It's a fantastic piece of software. And, I mean, granted, it is a buzzword, like Pat said, one of the buzzwords. It's not something that a general user would just, you know, sit down and throw one up right now in their home just yet. You know, you have little technical prowess about you to do it. But, yeah, it's you brought a product that allows people to do what was only reserved for phone companies before.
Right, and it is certainly, I think, very exciting that now, you know, you've got a really creative group of people out there in the open source community at large, especially in the Linux community, that now has access to start applying that creativity to something that really hasn't had a lot of room for that, which is, you know, in the telecom space in general. So, you know, people are coming up with very creative ideas for new services, some of which are entirely Asterisk-based, and some of which are combinations. So, for example, there was, you know, when the Katrina thing happened, you know, there were two of us that came up with bulletin boards, like voice bulletin boards for people that were, you know, displaced by Katrina to be able to look at each other. And, it, you know, it was just writing a Perl script that sat on top of Asterisk. You know, it was literally a question of a couple of hours to put that together, including the time that it took to get the voice prompts created. So, you know, it was very easy. I was talking to a guy in New York that has this interesting application that combines GPS with Asterisk to create these, like, real-world games. So instead of having just online 3D games where you have an online world and people in it, this is like one where you're actually, like, physically moving around and doing geocaching and that kind of stuff, with Asterisk providing the voice component of that. But, you know, it's pretty cool to see how it's all kind of coming together. It's also interesting because Asterisk has this whole sort of cottage industry of companies that have come out, like Ahiva and Finality and Switchbox and, you know, all kinds of little companies that are entirely based around Asterisk, you know, that they've got new products or they're going after some kind of, you know, vertical market, like, you know, Ahiva's going after contact center solutions and Finality's going after, you know, your really basic Office PBX where, you know, somebody that really doesn't know anything about telecom or Linux can just sit down and, you know, administrate their Asterisk server as easily as you administrate, like, a Linksys router or something.
As far as your customers, what are some of the bigger deployments that you guys have supported?
Well, we don't always know about all of our deployments because we sell through resellers and distribution, so we don't always get a whole lot of transparency into that. But there's one, Discovery Research, here in the States that's got, like, over 1,500 extensions on it spread out geographically across a very diverse area. And then you've got, of course, virtually any ITSP uses Asterisk at least somewhat within their network, and some of them are basically entirely based around Asterisk. So it depends on the scale of what you're trying to find. There's the city of Florsheim in Germany, whose whole municipal government standardized around Asterisk. They even put together German prompts and stuff for it.
So you have a solution here that is already playing with the big boys. Like, if we went out and looked at, I know when we were, where I work, when we started looking at a new phone system, I mean, you had Cisco coming in, a couple other vendors. I can't remember who we went on now. But you guys are playing in that arena?
Yeah, you know, it's really kind of interesting because Asterisk has had kind of an easier time breaking into the market than Linux did breaking into the operating system market. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. First off, Linux has kind of already paved the way, so people are used to the idea of open source and what that means and, you know, what that means about your ability to have, you know, good call quality and that kind of stuff. And you know, what it means economically. But the economic difference between open source and telecom is really serious, even compared with the operating system business. Because, I mean, you're talking about just, you know, huge sums of money, right? Like, it's really hard to look at, you know, I mean, we were working on a large enterprise customer, okay, and putting a quote together for them. And, you know, even with all the bells and whistles we could think of in terms of, you know, support and maintenance and all kinds of other things, right, we came in under 20% of the cost of the other more traditional solution, okay? I mean, that's really hard to, you know, that's really hard to not really move somebody, okay, that kind of price difference. And the third thing is that, you know, Linux kind of had to overcome this user interface issue where, you know, people are kind of used to the Windows interface and it's hard to get people to change, as well as this, you know, whole host of applications that were available for Windows that weren't available for Linux. And, you know, there's nothing like that in telecom. There's no one ubiquitous interface. There's no one ubiquitous system that other people create applications for. I mean, it's just this, all these, you know, individual companies that have their own products in that space. Now, the other thing I'll say, though, is that these vendors, you know, the Nortels, the Avayas, you know, all these guys in this space are not asleep at the wheel. They're definitely much more aware of Asterisk than I would have thought, and definitely were aware of it much earlier than I thought they would be aware of it. So it'll be interesting to see what strategies, you know, these guys come up with, you know, in the near future. But they're definitely aware of it. And, you know, when we went to the Vaughn show, which is a big Voice of IP show, Voice on Net, we actually ended up having the largest booth at the entire show. And the reason that we had the largest booth was because there was, you know, Digium at the center, and we had 12 partners around us that were all kinds of other companies building products around Asterisk. So you had, you know, Ahiva with their contact center stuff. You had Invenio, which is like a nonprofit that actually builds these bicycle-powered PBXs that get used over in Uganda and in West Africa. You had IBM in our booth, you know, demonstrating Asterisk with a high availability features that they had added to it, running on their Blade Center platform. You had Verso demonstrating Asterisk as an adjunct to their Class 5 carrier switch. And it was just, you know, all these different people with different stories about how they were using Asterisk and pushing Asterisk into a lot of different directions that were all enabled, you know, by this open source technology. And even if you got outside of the booth, you had, you know, companies, again, like Finality, you had, you know, AT&T demonstrating interoperability with Asterisk with their network. You had Intel, you know, announcing Asterisk support for their interface cards and software components. You had Polycom announcing, you know, interoperability with their product. I mean, it was just everywhere, you know, and it's really exciting. It's really exciting to see, you know, how quickly it's spreading and catching on.
Well, let me ask you a question about your business version that you sell. How do you distribute it? Do you have a stripped-down version of Linux on there? Is there a particular distribution that you use?
Right now, it's just basically RPMs, and we qualify it on, I think, Enterprise 3 and Fedora Core 3. But we'll probably have some more interesting distribution options coming up with the next release. I don't want to give away too many details here. But it'll be a little bit more interesting, I think, coming up.
Now, a couple of questions that people are asking on our IRC is, with an asterisk setup, what type of phones would you recommend, and how would you what devices would you recommend for interfacing a standard POTS phone into an asterisk setup?
Okay. Well, in terms of phones, you can use basically any voice over IP phone, primarily SIP phones, and there are also some EECS phones and some MGCP phones that will work with it. But pretty much most any phone that you get will work. Now, we also have the interoperability partners are the people that we go through and officially test against the Business Edition. If they work against the Business Edition, then you can be pretty confident they're going to work against, you know, the open source version as well. And then that would include, I think, Polycom, and I'm not sure if we've got some others officially there. But a lot of people kind of like the Polycom phones because of where they fit, you know, price-wise. You know, they're good quality phones, and, you know, they're certainly, I wouldn't call them, you know, cheap by any means. You know, your Grandstream is going to be a much cheaper phone, but, you know, in terms of a real office set, it's pretty good. If you're hooking up analog phones, then we actually make analog cards that you can use. We have a four-port card, the TDM40B, which allows you to hook up to four analog phones on it, and then we also have a 24-port card that we just announced that's shipping this month, and that's the TDM2400P.
So you guys have your own line of hardware that you sell specifically through Digium?
That's right, yeah, or through our distributors and resellers. And so, you know, we've got a lot of people that will take that hardware and put it into PCs and sell a solution. So if you don't really want to learn asterisk, you know, you can go to a reseller distributor and, you know, get a solution all put together for you. And we sell interface cards that connect T1s and E1s and PRIs and analog FXS, FXO, you know, basically any kind of traditional TDM interface that you come up with, odds are we have a, you know, a card to bring it into an asterisk PC. And they're, of course, fully supported.
Now, one of the devices... the IAXY?
I'm sorry?
The IAXY?
Yeah, the EECSY.
EECSY, yes. Now, that is a device that you would say if you were going on the road, you'd be able to plug in any internet connection and should be able to use the phone connected to your phone connected to the EECSY to connect back to your asterisk box, correct?
That's right, yeah. The EECSY is designed to run across basically any kind of broadband connection and give you a portable phone line that you can take with you.
Now, we have a couple questions regarding the EECSY.
Okay.
One, can the EECSY or will it ever support DNS lookups so that if you're using a dynamic IP address and DYN DNS addresses that they can easily use them outside the LAN without provisioning the EECSY?
Okay. The EECSY does not today support DNS. I don't know if it's going to support it in the near future or not. But it's almost certainly the most widely requested feature of the unit. So we have that in mind, and if we can make it work, then we certainly will.
In regards to reprovisioning these devices, I guess you can do that just by through the a web interface. And
the provisioning of the devices is done with either a standalone program or from within Asterisk. Asterisk can reprovision the device, and the logic here was that the EECSY was sort of designed for a service provider where having a web GUI wouldn't, you know, necessarily make a whole heck of a lot of sense. The EECSY is not like a normal ATA device. It doesn't run off of a DSP or a 32-bit processor. It actually runs off of an 8-bit microcontroller. So there's only 64K of flash and 4K of RAM. And within that little tiny amount of space, we run the whole EX protocol stack, the echo canceller, all the call features, and obviously the whole IP stack, okay, is all crammed into that little space. And it runs entirely deterministically as a single process, which means that it's, you know, obviously extremely reliable because it always runs the same way. And the thing with the DNS has to do with how small the platform is, and it's a little bit of a squeeze to try to get it in there. And then the obviously you're not going to put a web GUI into that either. But again, for a service provider, which is what it was originally intended for, you know, that's not really a big deal because they're always going to want to handle the provisioning in an automated way. And the EXE definitely supports that. You can change the provisioning on your Astro server, and you can actually have a provision to more than one server, such that your, you know, old server, if you move from an old server to a new one, you can actually have the EXE reprovision itself over to the new server too. But
okay,
I hope that helps answer it.
Now, what Fizone, who is our listener, would like to know that if you know how, or if you have the EXE Prove application, I guess is what you use to provision the EXE?
Right, that's the standalone one. And I think there's also a GTK EXE Prov, which is a graphical one, if you prefer. But yeah, go ahead.
So if you have that and the know how to use it and you know the IP of the device, you could reprovision anybody's EXE device, couldn't you?
Right. There's a lockdown feature that's not in the released one, but which should be available pretty soon.
And would that just be a simple firmware upgrade on
those
devices?
Yeah, that's just a firmware upgrade, and then you would set a bit that basically says, don't accept the provisioning except from the same server that you registered to.
Now, the license that you release Asterisk under, could you go into a little bit of detail as far as...
Asterisk is released under the GPL, just straight up GNU GPL. We have to make a couple of exceptions to allow linking with the G729 codec, which is covered by patents and is available as a pay-for add-on. We have to pay patent royalties for it. And there's an exception for OpenSSL, which is apparently incompatible with the native GPL. And there's an exception for OpenH323, which is a library that provides H323 support and is under a non-GPL compatible license, which is the MPL. So that's basically the licensing. If you contribute to Asterisk, if you want your changes to go into what we distribute as Asterisk, then we ask that you sign a disclaimer that basically it lets you retain your copyright, but it says that we can do whatever we need to do with the code so that, you know, we can continue to make the exceptions that we need to make and to be able to support the dual license.
How active has the user contributions been? Has it been a high volume or?
Yes, we've got over 350 contributors to Asterisk. There's a, you know, smaller set that, you know, really contributing on a very active basis. Most contributors, numerically speaking, are contributing a patch or a couple of patches that, you know, add some feature or fix some bug that they run into in their use of the software. But you have a few people who really are just, you know, really into Asterisk and contribute a lot of patches all the time. One of our biggest challenges as a company is to be sure that, you know, we do what we can to service the developer community to try to keep patches moving. You know, sometimes someone will contribute a large intrusive patch, and, you know, it takes a long time to get that kind of through. And, you know, we're definitely working hard to try to get, you know, better at that process. We're actually having a developer get together in Las Vegas during the IP for IT show, where we're going to bring a bunch of developers together to start working on new features and merge some of the post 1.2 stuff. So hopefully that'll be another another opportunity. But yeah, we really get a lot of developer contribution, and you know, we spend a great deal of time trying to process through that, you know, review patches, make recommendations for fixes where they need to be done, because you know, a lot of times when people contribute a patch, they're just contributing something that solves a problem for them, and they don't necessarily think about it within the scope of the rest of the Asterisk architecture. So, you know, the process of bringing those things in takes a lot of time.
What kind of turnaround do you have, you know, reviewing the patches and trying to get it implemented by?
It really depends. I mean, a lot of them, you know, most of the patches go through in either a matter of hours or a day or a couple of days. But the ones that are really intrusive, those tend to take a lot of time. And the problem, what makes it the hardest is that you get so many patches in. I mean, you're talking about between bug reports and patches, you know, somewhere between 250 and 500 a month, okay? So they're just constantly coming in. And the easy ones, it's so tempting to just focus on the easy ones where you can knock out, you know, four, five, six patches in a day, you know, going through, reviewing, committing, and, you know, getting it done real quickly. And that's sometimes the big ones. Those are the ones that take a lot more time. And it also depends on how responsive the original developer is to suggestions. So some developers, you can, you know, go back and say, you know, there's this function that already exists, and, you know, you go back and fix your patch to go use that other function, or, you know, have you considered architecting this a little bit different way, or here's this, you know, location where you could create a deadlock, so you need to figure out how to work around that. And you can go back to them, and they'll be happy to work on it. And then you have other developers who sort of make the patch, and then they don't really want to do anything else with it. You know, they're sort of like, well, okay, here's what I did. If you don't like it, you know, you don't have to add or whatever. So it depends on that side as well.
Now, recently, there's been a fork. There's another project, the OpenPBX project.
Right.
And I guess that was a small group of Asterisk contributors who decided to fork off the project.
Well, I don't know how many of them. I mean, there are a few of them I know that have been Asterisk contributors. There have been some forks in the past, too. And, you know, I certainly don't want to say that, you know, none of these forks are ever going to go anywhere. But a lot of times, you know, people just make a fork because it can, right? And you just go in and you change all the references and whatever. But what people don't realize is the amount of time that it really takes to keep something up to date. And, of course, as soon as you go off and fork something, you know, you've got this huge stream of patches that, you know, still has to be reviewed and merged and so on. And, you know, if you go take off your fork in some other direction, then, you know, you've got a lot of work ahead of you to try to keep those up to date. I mean, we even run into that just trying to manage the merges of patches from head into the stable release and into the business edition release. So we know how complicated and how time-consuming that process can be, especially as your code base diverges. And, you know, as much as I think, you know, certain developers have, you know, have gotten upset at the amount of time that it's taken in a few specific situations to get their patches merged, I think they also underestimate the amount of time that it takes to do the whole process, to merge any other patches from other people. I think they underestimate the value of code review. I mean, if you look at, you know, some of the patches, in fact, from one of the developers in particular, you know, there are a lot of cases where, you know, there's just code that's wrong. And, yes, it takes some time to get the code fixed, but it's better to get it fixed and put it in there where it works rather than have, you know, let anything come into the system and then have to figure out why it doesn't work somewhere down the road when it's not, you know, just sitting right there in front of you. So our goal is and, you know, always is to try to keep the quality of the Asterisk code base as high as possible and to work as much as we can to try to keep our developers happy. And, you know, fork or no fork, that's what we're always going to try to do. And in the end, that's why free software works, right? Because, you know, I call it extreme capitalism, right? Because every time anybody gets an edge, everybody's got the edge.
Now, have you communicated with these people outside of the mailing list?
With which people?
The people who are doing the OpenPBX project.
No, I really haven't communicated with any of them significantly after they've went off and did their fork. I mean, they're kind of on their own now.
So, what do you see the company going in the future? In a year or two?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we're obviously focused on the hardware, and we're also trying to come up with more stuff that we can make available for Asterisk at large to try to bring more people to the project and to be able to have more services to be able to offer. Part of the problem is that if you look in the long run, as the world moves more and more to voice over IP, the need for TDM interface cards is something of a shrinking need. So we're trying to kind of figure out all of what we're going to be doing in the future to try to be able to continue the kind of development that we do. I mean, Asterisk is a different project from a lot of things in that there's both a lot of community support, and by having Digium as a company behind it, we can pursue a lot of things that are, not things that the community is, really jumping to go do, like testing, right? I mean, when we do the testing for Business Edition, those bug fixes, of course, go back into the open source version as well. And, testing is not an area where, the open source community has really jumped up and said, hey, we want to participate in that, right? And you also have issues like certification. We have to have Asterisk certified in a lot of different countries in terms of its operation in order to be able to have customers in those areas that can connect it to the telephone network. Not to mention, obviously we have several full-time developers who are working on Asterisk code here, including Matt Fredrickson, Kevin Fleming, and myself. So it's, we want to do what we can to keep that going because we think that the mixture of having a community as well as a company and really a community of companies behind the project stands to benefit it and everyone that uses it very well.
Another thing that that the community doesn't seem to like to do a lot is documentation.
Yes, and I have to say that documentation is an area that we've really pretty badly failed on for the most part. I mean, the Business Edition does come with a manual, but if you look at, where the best documentation is, you've got the VoIP Wiki, you've got the Asterisk Documentation Project, and you've got the O'Reilly book by Life, Jim Van Magellan, and Jared Smith. And, those are all products that came out elsewhere than from us.
Yeah, because I know...
I would certainly encourage people to to help provide documentation, but once again, that's an area that, it's really hard to get people to go out there and really spend time documenting. I remember several years ago, there was someone that posted to the mailing list accusing us of actively discouraging documentation for the purpose of creating more support business, which I thought was pretty funny. But, in all seriousness, we're thankful for what people have been able to put together, and we certainly would like to encourage other people to help if that's an area. If they can't contribute code, we'd love to have them contribute documentation.
Yeah, we're going to have Alan write some up. I don't think he's ever even used Asterisk, have you? No, have one at home, right?
Yeah, I've got a box at home. It's not in use right now, but I've got one at home.
we've been running it for, what, 3-4 months now? 3 months?
Yeah, it's great.
It's been great.
Once you get it configured and you find all the necessary, you know, documentation to get it to where you want it, it runs like a top. It just keeps going. I forget it's even there half the time.
When Dan crashes different machines, the Astros box is still running. No problems.
No, that's what we, you know, are trying to keep going. I mean, if you look at our if you look at our bug tracker, you'll see that most of what's in there is feature requests and feature patches. There are, you know, relatively few bug reports, and of those, very few are crashes, majors, or blocks, which are our biggest deals we have to work on. We've got, I think right now there's about 130 open tickets out of 5,550 that have been submitted. So, you know, certainly in terms of numerically, we're pretty good at getting patches through the system and getting getting bugs resolved.
So how many developers do you have in-house?
Well, we've got, I'd say, around 8 people that are doing development at least part-time, but really there's, you know, 1, 2, 3, about 4 really full-time developers working on Asterisk stuff.
How big is the company now?
We've got about 40 people.
So you guys are growing.
Yeah, we're growing, but as I always say, we're the smallest telecom company in the world that matters.
So the other phone companies, PBX services, VoIP services, are they or hardware providers, are they giving you the hairy stink eye? They're not liking what you guys are doing? Are they feeling threatened yet by Asterisk?
I think it depends on the company. I mean, different companies have reacted differently to Asterisk's presence. The thing is that the telecom industry is really ripe with co-opetition, and it's really, amazing to see how, you know, a lot of people are competitors and yet, you know, are partners in other areas. And one of the things about Asterisk is Asterisk, just like it solves a lot of problems for individual people, solves a lot of problems for a lot of different companies, okay? So, for example, if you're a big soft switch company out there, Asterisk sure is a great gateway and a great voicemail platform, and you can't beat the price, and it makes your whole solution when you go try to sell this to a customer, you know, a lot more attractive. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, have this sort of love-hate relationship with Asterisk, but still make a lot of use of it because it benefits them even when their products overlap with what Asterisk feature sets are. So it really depends on the company. Some companies are, you know, really trying to push some sort of exotic features. Like I saw Avaya was demonstrating the ability to leave an IVR within a voicemail, right? So they had this demo where this, you know, stockbroker calls the customer and leaves them a message that says, you know, the stock you wanted is for sale at some price. You know, press 1 if you want me to buy it. Press 2 if you want me to buy, you know, 1,000 shares or whatever. Or press 3 if you don't want any. And then they'd listen to the message, and then they'd press, you know, 2 to buy the 1,000 shares. And it would say, you said you wanted to buy 1,000 shares. Press 1 if this is what you want, or 2 if not, and you press 1, and it goes, okay, and then it sends a message back, right? And I'm just thinking to myself, wouldn't that just be a lot shorter to just call the guy on the phone and say, hey, I want 1,000 shares? Okay, you know? So I don't know how much all these features are going to work, but other companies, I think, like Intertel, have, you know, been a lot more successful with that. If you look at their product, I mean, they've got all kinds of, you know, gee whiz bells and whistles and features that, you know, that would be very hard to catch up on, you know, in terms of speech recognition and, you know, graphical interfaces on the phones and whatnot. So they're really pushing to keep their products feature differentiated. And then you've got other companies that are kind of looking at Asterisk and seeing how they can integrate it in with some of their solutions that they've got.
Let me ask you, what drives new features? Is it your bigger customers asking for particular things, or do you guys sit around and look at what the competition's doing?
I didn't hear the first part of that question.
How do you decide what new features go in? Is it demand from your clients?
Well, there's basically the sources of features are what those of us that are working on Asterisk here at Digium decide we need to have. There's the features that our customers pay us for, and there's all the features that people contribute because they're out in the community and they want them. You know, one of the things I think that, you know, annoys some people is a lot of people say, well, what's the product roadmap? What's the, you know, feature roadmap for the next year? And, you know, in reality, the feature set is driven by the developers one way or another, whether it's the people that are being paid to do development or whether it's people developing out of their own needs or own ideas, you know, that's where it comes from. So, you know, it's pointless for us to go out there and say, you know, here's the set of features that Asterisk needs to have in the next year, unless we're the ones that are going to create those features. You know, it doesn't do a whole lot of good because it's the people themselves that need or will implement features that are going to be the ones that how that happens.
Mark, you guys are doing fantastic work, and we look forward to seeing future versions of Asterisk, and we'll continue using it.
I didn't hear the last part of that.
Well, we'll continue using your product. You know, we love Asterisk so far.
Oh, yeah. Well, we should have Asterisk 1.2 real soon now. We just released another beta on Monday. There's only a few things left that we really need to get in before we do the release. So hopefully very shortly we'll be able to announce that. And I would like to, you know, thank you, of course, for having me on the show. And also, I really want to thank any of your listeners out there that are developers or users of Asterisk today, and encourage you to kind of spread the word and see if we can continue to make a big difference. Yeah. You know?
Well, definitely, Asterisk, two thumbs up, man. That is fantastic work.
It's the new Apache.
Thanks.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
No problem. My pleasure.
A couple of quick other simple questions. What did you do your development? What platform, if it was Linux, what distribution were you using when you did the development of Asterisk?
Okay, so, you know, at the risk of being called a nub, I'm a Fedora user. I admit it. I've been a Red Hat Fedora user since probably about 96 when I switched over from Slackware. But I'm probably the only Fedora user here at the company that's not like in sales or something. Everybody else here is typically running Debian. We've got a SUSE user, and we have lots and lots of Gentoo all around, even that is not at all my distribution of choice. You know, my personal feeling is if I'm going to watch something, it better be Asterisk.
And now, did you use a specific IDE for the development, or are you just Emacs or VI?
I use Netit and Make, typically. My text mode editor of choice is Jove, which is really kind of esoteric.
Ah, Jove and Netit, huh?
Yeah, those are definitely my favorites.
Now, what window manager are you using over there? GNOME?
Okay, so this is going to come as a shock to people that, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but you guys know Game, obviously, right?
Sure.
So I started Game when I was in college as a project to learn GTK, right? And every graphical application that I've ever written for Linux has been in GTK, but I actually run KDE on my desktop, although I do use Game, obviously.
So, GTK? So you prefer GNOME over KDE?
No, I use KDE as my desktop.
Oh. Okay.
But I program. I prefer to program in GTK.
GTK.
Primarily, that comes out of my appreciation for C and my general distaste for C++, which I feel is merely a crutch for people who can't think in object-oriented terms on their own.
You're starting a flame war.
I'm starting what? The flame war? Yeah.
Yeah.
So now you said you moved. You used to use Slackware, and then you moved over to the Red Hat / Fedora line in 96?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting. That's great. You know what? I want to thank you so much for coming on.
No problem.
We would definitely like to hopefully call you again in the future and check up with you if that's okay.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
And I thank
anytime,
you.
Anytime you guys want.
Yeah, thank you for all that you've done for the community, and have a happy holiday, because Thanksgiving's
thank
right
much.
Around the corner.
And thanks again to you guys and to your listeners.
Yeah, thank you. Those, Mark, we appreciate it, and we'll be hanging up and talk to you later.
Okay, cool.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Mark Spencer.
That was a good conversation.
Fantastic. It's always great to talk to somebody who's done some fantastic stuff in the community.
It's great, man. These guys are, they developed the project. You know, they got a great product that's out there. You know, they're not charging for the product itself, but, they have a business model built around support and selling support hardware. It's they're going out and doing it, It's a guy's startup from nothing, basically.
And Alan sold his ass. Open sourced his ass.
Is that why he walks funny?
You know what I want to do before we run out of time?
We've got like 3 minutes.
Yes, we have plenty of time, Alan. Plenty of time.
Well, not
past couple of days, I've been really working in Kino. And I'm trying to put together a little holiday DVD for the family.
You going
to
go all out and do graphical menus and
I'm
all
deal? I'm hoping to do that. But I don't know.
Dan's porn.
I'm only at the point, I've got a lot of video, and importing the video takes a long time.
Oh, you got to do it in real time.
What?
When you import, you're just basically playing the
right,
camera.
Right, yeah, you do it. And I have like 2 60-minute tapes worth of stuff that I got to.
That's a lot. 120 minutes worth of footage,
Yeah, so I got to, go through it. And it's easy to do in Kino
it
to
is.
Import it, but you're right. It is weird. I've used iMovie in the past, and comparing Kino to iMovie, some of the stuff I like and don't like. First off, let's get the likes away. I feel I have more control in Kino than I do in iMovie.
That's not a surprise.
Right. And I feel I have more functionality, more features. But on the same token, it's not as easy to use. Now, once again, I've sat down to use Kino without reading a single bit of documentation. And I've been able to get to the point of editing or pulling in a video, editing it, splicing together different clips.
Changing clips in the timeline, that kind of sort of thing.
Yeah, moving timelines around. Putting in transitions.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done any additional audio stuff, but doing transitions I have. I found that you should save frequently.
Yeah, especially if you're doing transitions and for some reason it crashes on you.
Right.
Save with reckless abandon.
Yeah, save with reckless. I haven't had a problem with the transitions.
Really?
So
all of them worked for you, no problem?
Right. Well, sometimes I have a problem when I'm editing
bad things
too many
may
things.
Happen.
Like if I try and edit, if I cut down a clip a couple times. What?
You know what I had a problem with when I was doing, I was trying to trim down one of my clips, and for some reason it kept bombing out on me. So what I wound up doing was taking the clip and splitting it at the point where I actually wanted to cut it off. And then once I did that, I just, deleted the piece that I split out.
An interesting thing that you're talking about right there. I had a different problem, but when I took this video, and it was I wanted to make it all one clip. And it came in as how sometimes it comes in as multiple different clips?
Yeah, depending upon how long the actual clip that you imported is.
Right.
It might break it out to separate files.
It broke it into two different clips, and I wanted to put that together. But for some reason, no matter how many times I did an export out to digital video, because I was going to, I'd taken these little clips, I clean them up a little bit, export them out to a DV format, so that I can pull them in when I want to put them all together for the final, longer clip. But it kept splitting this clip. No matter what I do, when I'd save it, it would split that clip for some reason. It seemed to be like a little glitch in the audio or something that was causing
it. Now, was it, did you pause while you were recording or no?
No.
It was a seamless.
Well, it was a seamless thing, but it split that. You know, like if you were to do, like if you were to pull in your video and say you were shooting, you stopped shooting and you started again, and you stopped, and you started again. You know, you shot three different scenes.
Right.
And when you pull it into Kino, it'll make clips out of those three different scenes.
Right.
So, well, for some reason, it cut that scene.
Maybe you had a bad frame in there?
It might have been a bad frame, but no matter what I do, well, after I cleaned it all up and did what I wanted and I'd save it, it would still split it right there.
Right there.
I get two separate AVI files for some reason. Now, when I exported out to an MPEG, it didn't happen.
Huh.
So something was a little quirky there. When editing on the interface, you have the first option is edit, then you have import, then you have timeline.
Right.
One of the problems I kept having was sometimes I click on over here when I'm in the timeline and I click on the clip or something, and it would jump me back up to the edit mode. And then I'd be in like the edit mode and I'd move and the clip would move out of its position on the left and it would drop into another place. So I had to be careful of that, how I did that. And there was one point where I got so foobarred into what, you know, because I was trying to cut scenes out. Like sometimes you get a little bit of, like if you might have like you started off and like I would have two sections I want to record a section, pull it in off the tape, and there was something before it and something after it. So I'd started a little before, so I have that section, and then it would end a little after.
Speak into the mic, Dan.
Yeah, a little after. So I have some extraneous clip footage on either end of the clip I wanted. And sometimes when editing that, because
would you try to do a trim?
Yeah, I would trim it down a little bit. It's not as easy to trim in Kino as it is in iMovie, but still, you could do it by frame. So it takes a little getting used to. After I used it for about an hour and a half, I got really down.
It's easy to pick it up once you get going.
Right. Shoot, we got to cut off a bin rev. But I'm going to keep going anyhow.
Yeah, we'll keep talking. Good night, bin rev.
All right. So Kino, I thought, was really great. And I did some exports in a different format just to play
around. Me too. I like that.
It seemed
it's great.
To work really well. I didn't have any problems. Now.
Did you try to do it at a DVD file system?
No, not yet.
Try that. I did the Theoro because when I was editing the video that I shot for the DVD, I exported it to a Theoro file. And that worked pretty good, man. It was pretty quick, faster than actually doing a DVD file system. That takes a long time. That takes a couple hours.
You know, I wouldn't doubt it. But I had a problem. Only problem is... Now, Kino is really finicky on what files you can pull in.
Yeah. There's only so much that you can use coming
right.
in.
Now, I have an old... Back about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, I put together a little CD with video clips on it from... When I first got my capture card, an analog camcorder, I would capture it, and it was on Windows when I was using Windows for this. It was about 7-8 years ago, and I put together a little movie, and I have that movie. It's an MPEG format, and I would love to include this on the DVD.
So you probably got to convert the file format.
Right, so I was trying to figure out how the heck I'm going to get to convert this. So I was using different things. I could not get it in under Kino, all right?
It's funny you mention that because Alan, for the DVD, Alan had shot a whole bunch of footage on his CVS camera, and all the clips he gave me, they were all AVI, little short clips, you know, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever. So what I needed to do is I needed to combine them into one file, okay? I tried bringing them into Kino.
Well, next time you need something, let me know because I can convert those guys before I give them to you.
Well, I tried doing it in Kino, and for the life of me, I couldn't get it to import correctly into Kino, so... I'm actually going to try to do it in another video editor. I'm actually going to try to do Cinelera or maybe Lives.
No.
I got both of those installed and ready to go, so I'm going to try it.
I went down the Cinelera route, and...
That is so crazy, man.
It was...
It's so tough. It's so non-intuitive, Cinelera.
And every time I exported out, I tried Theora, I tried...
How do you export the file? I was looking for the export... I was just going to...
It's Render.
Render?
Render. And it was just it was such a pain. I think the Theora worked. The AVI file didn't. When I play it back, the AVI wouldn't play back. I could not get either one of those in the Kino. Not at all.
I tried also using Avid Demux. Now, I've used that in the past for like some recordings that I did when I had the MythBox running.
Uh-huh.
It seems, for whatever reason, every time I import videos into Avid Demux, it seems that the more clips that you add, the further back you go in the stream of the actual file, it seems that the audio goes out of sync. And I've experienced this on my old box, too, and I thought it was just related to the fact that I had a VIA chipset. But, my machine's a fairly new machine, so... And it's a good system. I've never had any problems in any applications that I've used so far, so I'm thinking it's something with... I'm not doing something correctly in Avid Demux. But I'm going to try Sonolara and maybe Lives as well.
Now, I did get that MPEG file in the Kino, and I did it using Lives.
What'd you do? You exported it?
I got Lives. Ubuntu doesn't.
That's a weird interface,
Lives,
too. It's just one window.
Did you install? Did you install the package?
From
because I compiled it.
No, I installed the package from one of the repositories in Debian.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't.
It's weird because on the bottom of Lives, they have like this little window where it looks like it's all like the messages when you're doing encoding. It's just kind of odd that it's there. It's like, why do you have to see that? You know?
Yeah, and again, I have not done any research in the documentation.
Me either. I'm
did
serious.
Did you pull anything into Lives?
Yes, actually.
It took like forever.
Yeah, it's slow to load it in.
What it does is it,
compared to Cinelara, which is much quicker.
It exports every single frame out to a JPEG file.
Really?
It does. If you look into the temp directory, it converts it. I think it uses primarily MJPEG, if I'm not mistaken. The MJPEG tools. It'll pull it out, convert every single frame into a JPEG file. Because if you go into the temp directory for Lives, you'll see every single frame. So my video, the page movie is what it was called, is about 7.5 minutes long. It took, I don't know how long it took to get that movie in. All I know is I started it, and I thought it was not working properly.
Started it, I went to bed, woke up the next morning, went to work, and it was still going.
You laugh, but that's the truth, man.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't, because it just kept going and going, and I thought, would this thing crash or something? Because
encoding video is
this wasn't encoding, this was
just
loading
them in, yeah.
And I stopped it, and I previewed it, and when you preview it, it stops, and everything seemed to be working, but it was taking so long. So I left, and I came back, I don't know how much longer. It was in there, so then I... with Lives, the weird thing about it is when you go to save it, you can't select the format you want. You actually have to go into the preferences and choose the default encoder. Yeah, encoder. And there's tons of choices.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
I had to get some extra packages. I had to get was the SWF tools because you can obviously encode that movie into a Flash movie, which is cool. The other thing I got was...
Lives looks awesome. I mean, I was looking on the website, and there were some demos that you could download. It seems very powerful and very, very, you know, real intense stuff and really flexible.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And it supports H.264, which is, you know, the new high-definition codec.
So I got the movie, and I wanted to export it to digital video format, and I chose medium
quality. To go back
quality.
To a camera?
What's that?
Why'd you go to digital video? So that you could bring it into
Kino? So I
can
bring it into Kino. Okay. Because I knew if I export it into some...
Because that seems to be the default format that Kino likes.
That's what it seems like. So I selected that, and it said to me, well, in order for us to export to this format, we need to resample all the files. So I let it go, and it took about 2 hours for the 7 minute. But it did it flawlessly.
This is on your new machine, right? What is it, like a 2.8?
Yeah. It's 2.2.
And how much memory you got in there?
It's 512 megs.
Yeah, that's very similar to my system.
Yeah, it took about 2 hours to actually do all that. And when it was finished, it was beautiful. And it came right into Kino.
No problem. No problems with the audio?
Not at all. Everything
was cool, man.
Worked perfectly. So, and there is a ton of stuff in Lives. Different transitions, different stuff that you can do. Again, the only downside I see to it is... The interface is it's really different.
It's weird, yeah. It's one big window, you know, which is the complete opposite of, say, Cinelara, which has like 4 or 5 different windows that open up once you start it up. I'm going to bite the bullet. I definitely want to learn, one or possibly both of these, you know, really get into it and learn how to use it. You know, so I'm just scratching the surface. It's definitely something. You know, Kino is really flexible. It's really great for doing like home videos and stuff like that. You know, but it seems somewhat limited as far as like the high end stuff. So I mean, it's a cool tool. Don't get me wrong. I love Kino.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm gonna primarily do most of my work in Kino, only because it's faster.
It's great. Well, the best part of Kino is the export utilities, man. You can go in, you can export it to Theora, you can export it to a DVD, you can export it to a video CD. It's just very flexible, you know?
So what my plan is, this is what I'm thinking, because again, I think I need to sit down and read the documentation on these products, but I think I'm going to put together...
You definitely do.
Yeah.
You really do.
I'm going to put together, like, the clips that I want. I'm going to put together the chapters, so to speak, export them out in the individual... video clips, video chapters, individual video files, and pull it all together with maybe QDVD author.
Right. You can put it out to us. And I think QDVD author, you need to have a pull in an MPEG file. It's the same thing with DVD styler. So the whole thing with going to DVD styler or QDVD author is that I don't think it'll retain the chapter indexes. Like when I export in Kino to a DVD format, which will generate, you know, the file system, it'll have like the scene breaks, you know, where you put your transitions in. Once you finalize your file system and burn your DVD, you can, you know, go to the different chapter indexes, you know, no problem with the, you know, with a regular player. Okay. You know, the way it is now, QDVD author and DVD styler, they don't import those chapter indexes. It's not a seamless integration. And now last week's interview, when you guys were talking to Varro, he talked about being able to include the XML files generated in Kino. That will help that situation to a large extent.
You know, you brought up a good point there. See, I was thinking of, you know, each chapter being its individual file, and I wasn't really thinking about, you know, if I had it, if I did it in Kino, I can make a transition between each chapter. Like, each transition point, each one of those individual clips, you put a transition, that would be an individual chapter, right?
Correct.
Now, I was thinking, well, I just take those and export each chapter as its own video file. I wonder how I pull that all together in QDVD author.
It'd probably be messier if you had individual MPEG files you're talking for each scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would probably be messier.
But if I did it all in Kino and export it and then pulled it into QDVD author, how do you tell QDVD author where that...
You got to go in and manually set the indexes where you want the chapter indexes to be. The same thing with DVD styler.
When you do it, I haven't played around with it yet, but when you do it manually, do you, like, watch the video or something?
There's, like, a time index, and you can go in and move it to where you want to put it.
Oh. See, that's not too bad.
No, it's not too bad. It's not, you know, ridiculous. But Varro was saying that he is going
to... It'd be nicer if it could pull
that it's
in.
Seamless. You know, like how iMovie integrates nicely with iDVD, where once you have the movie all edited and cut and everything, you just import it into iDVD, and you got everything there, and it's all complete. That's where it needs to go, you know? To be on the same playing field with those applications, I think. It's getting there slowly, you know. And the whole thing is, and everybody's doing their own thing. But Lives looks really cool, and Cinelaro is really... The version that I pulled down installed, it seemed to be a very recent CVS version. And it looks like it's changed quite a bit since the last time I played with it. So I'm going to read the documentation for both those applications and try to work with them a little bit. It's good stuff. Alan, have you done any of this video stuff?
No, I don't have a camera.
You should check it out, man.
Besides the CVS camera, I don't have one.
The CVS camera is decent quality, man. It's not that bad, actually.
Oh, no. I've actually had some fun with that one.
The only limitation, you can only do like 20-minute clips, right?
20 minutes at a time, yeah.
That's okay, though. You know?
Well, every time you hit the record button on there, it just creates another AVI file. So it's
how
all
much,
nicely split up.
How much memory do you have?
I have no clue what's in there. Whatever gets 20 minutes of video out of it, I don't know, to be honest with you.
Now, when I did the video that we shot, I edited it down to about 45 minutes, and then I encoded it to a Theora file. I did the highest quality Theora, and it was about 800 meg for 45 minutes, which is pretty good. Considering 45 minutes with a, you know, DVD MPEG format, probably be in the range of 3 gig or so.
Now, when you did that, did you create the ISO and then burn it to DVD?
No, I went straight through.
And you did that through Kino?
Actually, what I did was I created the DVD file system. When you have a DVD file system, there's two directories, Video TS and Audio TS. Okay, it seems like nothing ever gets placed in Audio TS. It's whatever when they designed the specification for it, they had the two folders. But everything is in the Video TS folder. So what happens is when Kino does the export, when you do the DVD, it'll create those menus, the Video TS and the video, the Audio TS file. So what you need to do is you need to do a command to take that and to make either a DVD ISO. Once you have the DVD ISO, you can use a command line or whatever burning application you want to burn the DVD ISO. I use K3B because it's simple drag and drop because it's an ISO file.
What do you want, Alan? You leaving?
Yes, I'm taking off. So good night to everybody.
We're going to be closing down in just a second, but we wanted to finish up. Okay. One last thing. So, because that's what I was concerned about. I want to get a DVD burner to, like, what, $30?
They're cheap nowadays.
Yeah, but I'd say the only burner I have right now is on this machine.
Yeah, later
so
for
I'm
that.
Thinking, what?
Later for that.
I was thinking, if it came down to it, I didn't get a DVD burner time, I could just export it in some way, get it into an ISO format, bring it over here and burn it.
Yeah, you could do that.
Because I burn DVDs on
a DVD ISO format's universal. You know? You should be able to burn it in any application that you use, command line, whatever.
Yeah.
It's good stuff, man. We'll get into it.
Guess we'll pack it up for tonight.
Yes. Our guest for next week, we're going to have the EFF chairman, Brad Templeton.
Awesome.
Yeah, it should be a really good guest. I'm sure we're going to talk about DRM and the DMCA and RIAA and all those other good things that we like to talk about occasionally.
Now, what happened to the Tux Magazine person?
I actually spoke to him today. He's confirmed he's going to be on the 23rd.
Excellent.
So, we've got some interesting guests coming up. And again, people, go on Frapper and add yourselves to the map.
Yeah, we want to see where you're all from.
Yeah, it's cool, You can put a little picture up there if you want. And a little.
We need to work on Africa and Australia.
We
and
actually had people in Australia and Africa.
They haven't checked in yet. So.
Yeah, we're a little thin in Europe, so all our European listeners, please go on there and add yourselves.
We need to dig up a Russian one, too. There was nobody in Russia.
I think we had one Russian guy emails, but I think he was in New York, so that doesn't really count.
Not unless he lies, but...
You know what? Tony Freeman sent us an audio letter.
That's right, a couple weeks ago, right?
Never got to it. I have it. Can we quickly play it out?
Yeah, go ahead, man. Do it.
You want to listen to it? Let's listen to it, because I don't want to put this off another week, because he's waited long enough.
This audio email is coming to you from Louisville, Kentucky. I finally talked my wife into letting me continue to think about buying a high-end workstation for gaming, development, and computation. My question is specifically about hard drives. What is the fastest and most reliable hard drive to purchase? What would your dream hard drive be? For me, I'm thinking only of speed. I'd like to get a drive that can do at least 10,000 RPMs. However, I wonder if I should also consider other things besides speed. One more thing. While researching this Linux machine, I see there are two choices for hard drives, SATA and SCSI. Please help me figure out what I need to focus my energies on when it comes to purchasing a quality hard drive. Yours, Tony Freeman.
All right.
That's a good question.
That's a great question. And you know what? I don't have an answer.
Either one of those. I used to have SCSI, but I sold that drive.
Right.
This is what we need Link here for.
Yeah, he's into servers and
yeah, I have not. I've used SCSI, and first I would be inclined to say SCSI is the way to go, but SATA now.
It's cheaper, isn't it?
I'm not sure what the pricing is, and I have not been able to get my hands on a SATA drive yet because I'm a poor boy.
The newer machines all come with serial ATAs now.
Right, I do have a serial ATA in there. What I want to do is, people, think about that question. What has your experience been? What do you recommend? Send us an email, post to the forums, let us know. We're going to do some research to answer his question for next week, Tony Freeman's question, and give our suggestions and recommendations. I don't want to just go out and say, yeah, go SATA, because I know that some SATA drive controllers, there's some problems.
I've never used serial ATAs yet.
Right, and it's something I haven't had a chance to play around with yet. A lot of SCSI devices should work pretty well.
Yeah, they're pretty reliable SCSI. I mean,
right, but SATA, it's not brand new. It's been out for
it's
a
like
year
the next
so
generation
now.
Of IDE drives, right? It's serial ATA.
And I know that there were some initial problems, so we're going to look into that. And you know, people out there, if you have recommendations or experiences, please let us know so we can better answer Tony Freeman's question. That's what we're going to do for this week. We're going to play us on out of here with something. I don't know what yet. Pat, any last comments?
No.
Any last comments from you, Alan?
Good night, all.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I don't know. I don't know.
Till next time.
Same bat time.
Same bat channel.
We'll roll out of here. I don't know. I don't even know what I want to play to roll out of here. Oh, I got to be careful because I turned up the volume for.
Don't blow us out.
Yeah, for Tony's letter. I don't want to blow everybody away. If you have any questions or comments or whatever, send them to techshow@thelinuxlink.net.
And let us know if you want a DVD. We'll get that out to you.
Yep. Pat will be selling the DVDs. How much are they again?
$10. We're going to send them express, so you'll get them within a couple of days. So drop us an email. You know, we take PayPal, or you could do a money order or whatever. Or check even. But any way possible.
Yeah. And that's...
That's all she wrote. Deep throat.
That's all she wrote. All right. That's all we have. Thank you for listening. Next week, come back for... Who is it again?
Brad Templeton from the EFF.
Brad Templeton from the EFF. Pat's always on top of that stuff. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you later. Have a good one. Bye.
Adios.
Humankind cannot gain anything without first giving something in return. To obtain, something of equal value must be lost. That is alchemy's first law of equivalent exchange. In those days, we really believed that to be the world's one and only truth.
You know I want to tap that ass, right? It's over.
It's all over. You know I'm going to have to like really pump the export out on this this wave, I think. Huh? I don't know. Yeah, we got it, no problem. Well, I guess we shouldn't have really called that in the middle of a conversation with him. I was like, "Who should I? Should I try?" Yeah, not smart doing all that. Well, we have a really important guest on tonight, so let's max out the line. What? How dare you? I didn't get a Slurpee. You don't get your silence. I'm just kidding. I'll keep it down. I'm sorry. Wait.